That'd be fantastic. I got a lot of questions.
Okay, so I guess by way of introduction to a question and answer session, just to get the ball rolling a little bit, it is something that a lot of times you go visit yeshivas, that the yeshivas will ask if you could do a question and answer session with the guys. So I think just from a guy's perspective, it's important to know who's who, like who you're asking which questions to. So like Lamashal, when someone of the caliber of Moreno Rav Schechter, Moreno Rav Willig, Moreno Rav Sachs, comes to yeshiva, so you could ask a certain level of question, meaning dealing with, big people. When it's people of a, of the next caliber or two or three calibers below that, it would be a different type of question. So like, the question should not be, there's a neighbor of mine who's not Guna, and I need you to be matir her. We're not working on that level over here. Just to make it clear, the Gemara says in Maseches Brachos that a person should be Ragil Lomar Eini Yodea. The Yerushalmi says that a person should always say, should be used to saying, I don't know. That's an okay thing to say. I was with Rav Asher Weiss 2 weeks ago, and he said, just today I told somebody I don't know. So that was like a chiddush for him. Like he told somebody he didn't know something. So, I learned from my Rebbe that when you don't know, you should say that you don't know. So I apologize in advance if the answer to three-quarters of your question is, I don't know. But that's, in the piece, that's what we're dealing with. Okay, so given that, yes?
What do you think about betting on the Gaf?
I actually have some thoughts on that issue. What is betting on the daf? So there was a crazy shayla. Some crazy speaker came to the yeshiva recently, and told over a shayla that a guy had suggested when he saw all of the new people coming to learn daf yomi, he suggested to the rabbi of his shul that what we should do is we should get all the new people who just started the daf to put $2,711 into an account. And for every daf that they do, they'll get $2 back. And then all the profits the shul will keep. And he assumed that there will be a lot of profits because everyone will drop out after everything. So I think that this is the definite, this is above Basra Sugya, right? Asmachta is above Basra. Everyone knows that it's Sanhedrin Sugya. By Sanhedrin, it's a machlokas whether it's Asmachta. Right? Above Basra, we define Asmachta. You didn't get there yet. It's like way later, right? Okay, but you'll get there because you'll be Messiah above Basra. Right? Yeah, of course you will. So, but Basra defines Asmachta. In a few places we define Asmachta, but see also we define Asmachta. So Asmachta is that if I make a deal, then if I don't do this, then I will pay you X or whatever. And clearly the plan is that I'm going to do it, not that I'm going to pay. Right, so then it's a smachta to take that money from the person. Like, for example, I think the case in Mo Basra is that Reuven owes Shimon $100. Reuven pays back $25, so he still owes Shimon $75. But they have a shtar. Shimon's got a shtar that says that he's owed $75. So then he's owed $100, right? Because that was the shtar. The original shtar was for $100. So Shimon gives the shtar to a third party, to Levi. And Reuven says to Levi, if I don't pay him back in full by tomorrow, then you can give him back the shtar. Which means what's going to happen if you give him back the shtar? He'll collect the full 100. So the Gemara says that's a smachta. Why is that a smachta? Because clearly I'm not planning on having to pay more than the $100. I'm planning on actually paying him back by tomorrow. I was just saying that to show my confidence in my ability to pay back by tomorrow. But if I clearly plan on doing X, and when I don't do it, there's going to be a penalty, I don't really want to pay that penalty. And when you take that money from me, that's going to be a violation of a smachta. So I thought this is a smachta. Meaning everyone who goes in on learning the daf thinks, I'm going to do it. Especially if they're putting down $2,711 on it. Right? I'm going to do it. Of course I'm going to do it. And they don't realize that when they drop out in Erevin or in Shabbos, that all their money is going to be going to paying other guys who actually are doing it. Right? So I thought that was a violation of Asmachta. I also thought there's another problem over there, and that is that when you're dealing with money that would otherwise be designated for a shul, and this is just a good thing to know, many of you one day will be board members of a yeshiva, shul, some other institution. You're dealing with mamon hegdish, and your own money you could invest, and you could take risky investments, and you can, you know, hope for the best with it. But with mamon hegdish, you're not allowed to make investments. You're not allowed to take any sort of risks with mamon hegdish, with some exceptions. It's Eliezer, where he writes in the tshuva, that if you have someone to cover all potential losses, then maybe you could do it. But otherwise, you're not supposed to take risks with mamon hegdish. So I thought, from that perspective also, because what if everyone does it? And then the shul's going to be out a lot of money, right? Meaning, granted, chances are the shul will make money on it. There's at least some chance that the shul won't. So I thought that would be usher as well. So we did not do it. I said, if you want to do it, that you get $1 back for each stuff that you do, that's okay. That you're allowed to do. That's just supporting Talmud Torah. That I thought was okay. Yeah?
What about the pigeons of belly
treating? So it's not fair to the guys who weren't here before. It's ridiculous. I already gave a share on my talk about that. You can listen to it from the rabbi's desk share. I mean, the truth is, wherever I speak about it, someone will come over to me afterwards and will say, you shouldn't say it's ridiculous. It worked, and this big Yirei Shemayim, this big Talmud Chacham told me about it, and it worked, and that. It's ridiculous. They say that it cures hepatitis, that if you take a pigeon and put it on someone's belly and then wait for the pigeon to die and then another, it's ridiculous. Someone sent me a video of it. And a friend of mine told me that he did it. I'm trying to remember who it was. A friend of mine told me that, I know who it was. He said, that being DRS. He told me that he did it when he was younger. He was in Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael and he was sick and he told me which rabbi in Far Rockaway did this on him and he so he did this whole procedure. And he said, I don't know, I didn't know, I wasn't sick the next day. Hepatitis cures itself after a short amount of time. So if you have the right kinds of hepatitis A, B, and C, I forgot which one. One of them just goes away after a couple of days. So if you have that one, then the pigeons will work. If you have the other one, then... So it doesn't come from the Jewish people, but the Jewish people, like we have done with many other people's superstitions, we have latched onto it and embraced it, which is, as Rav Shach always points out, we're the only religion that doesn't believe in superstition. We're the only religion that actually prohibits superstition, and the Jews are more superstitious than any other people. It's the strangest thing. We have all these crazy superstitions, and it doesn't make any sense. We hold the red string, you know, that's a sefta in Masechta Shabbos says that it's Darkei Amori. That's where it comes from, but we do it. Debesina Rav writes in the Tshuva that it can't be that the red string is problematic because his babi was a very religious Jew and she was a big Yirei Shemayim and she insisted that they all wear a red string. Okay. But Tashlis is what it says in the Tosefta. It's interesting, Rabbi Belsky in his Sefer, Rabbi Yisrael Belsky was a posik for the OU, he's Rashiv of Torah Das, and is probably in terms of Talmid HaChacham, the greatest genius in America. Living in this century, at least, passed away a few years ago. When I say greatest genius, I mean like in terms of not only his yediyas ha-Torah, but his yediyas ha-everything. He knew everything. Like not only like chachmos, like sciences and math and things like that, like everything, like carpentry. He knew everything. They said that the OU misses him terribly, because like he would look at a tanker truck and trying to figure out bittul b'shishim, he'd figure out the circumference of the width. Like he would like do the math in his head, and he'd be like, "Oh, that's about 74 times the volume of whatever." Like he would. They don't have anyone that could do that anymore. Like he would figure out how enzymes work, and how, and he would understand all the science behind everything. They don't really have it. Rosh Hashanah's not really interested in that stuff. You know, I mean, enzymes he is interested, but a lot of other things, like he just doesn't. You know, but it's a real, real, real phenomenal genius. So Belsky has a book about superstition and Judaism, about like these healers. A lot of times people have alternative medicine and healing people. So he has a whole book ranting against it. He didn't write the book. He gave a number of shiurim about it. His children wrote the book. And it was so interesting that when it came to the red string, he said, from Jews have always done that. That we do. That was it. Like, that's... The whole book is a rant against all these other superstitions, and when it came to that one, he didn't want to touch it. So that's something that he discusses in that book, his conversations with practitioners of these alternative medicines. And he'll say, maybe where are your numbers? Where's your data? He'll say, oh, the government seized my data because they don't want anyone to know. You know, like, so it's these kinds of people, the man never landed on the moon, it's a conspiracy theory, the Israelis blew up the Twin Towers, you know, control, if you think that could happen without a controlled explosion, you know, like it's crazy, like it's the absolute Michigan, the anti-vaxxers, you know, that whole cesspool. There's a double look, he did an interview with a major anti-vaxxer, and he somehow had a sense that the guy was a total quack. So he said to the guy, because the guy was saying how all of this is a government conspiracy in order to support the insurance companies, and you know, the vaccines are killing people, and the government is in cahoots with the insurance companies to kill all these people through these vaccines, and you know, he started saying this whole thing. So he said, can I ask you, how did the Twin Towers fall? So the guy said, oh, I'm not going to get into that. But if you believe that two planes could take down the net, like, okay. You know, like, okay. Yeah. So we shouldn't be into every Mishagas. We should be into learning Torah. That's what we should be into.
Uncle just asked me, he told me that it's very close to even cloning people today. What would be halacha's status of a cloning person? The kind of a minion?
This is like the tshuva of the Chacham Tzvi about a golem. Right? Is a cloned person the same as a golem? What does it mean cloning a person? They use the DNA, but they're not going to produce the person in the lab.
In the lab.
What?
Make a person
they'll
in the
they'll
lab.
Actually be able to make a person in the lab?
Yeah.
Meaning,
what
I assume that what they're going to have to do is that the child is going to have, there's going to have to be some sperm, an egg of a mother and a father, and they'll just be able to manipulate the DNA to make it that all of the DNA belongs to one or the other, right? Meaning, there's no way they're going to be able, without an egg, there's no way, I don't think we're anywhere near that. Meaning, just taking a cheek swab and then, you know, putting it in the machine and the person comes out. I don't think we're there yet. That would be a very fascinating question. You have the question of meat, right? That they could produce meat just from a little bit of DNA. So that's the question, whether it's part of. And whether such meat would, you won't need shechit anymore. The prices will go way, way down. Right now, it's still like 20 times the price of whatever. But eventually, if they do it, regularly and they perfect the process, so that could be taka, a big help. These are very tricky questions in terms of determining paternity, maternity more than paternity. You have now it's ma'isim b'chol yom. You have one mother that whose egg was used, is the genetic mother, and another mother who's the gestational mother, who carried the baby. So there are women that have viable eggs, but for some reason they're unable to carry a pregnancy, for illness or whatever other reason they're unable to carry a pregnancy. What they do is they get a surrogate. So a surrogate, if you pay a woman $150,000. Or whatever it is, costs a lot of money, because who's going to want to carry a pregnancy for 9 months and then give up the baby? So you pay someone to take your pregnancy, and they implant that egg into that person, and then the shaila becomes who the mother is. I was sitting with Rav Shachter once in the OU office. He got a phone call, and we got to listen in, where the shaila was the grandparents of a baby that were calling. The grandparents are from. Their daughter is not from anymore. The daughter lives in the Midwest somewhere. She married a Jewish man. She's not. They're not religious, and the daughter was unable to carry her own pregnancy. So they used the daughter's egg. They got a surrogate who is not Jewish to carry the baby, and now they have a baby who is a Suffolk Jew. Because who's the mother? Is the mother the genetic mother? Or is the mother the gestational mother? So they have a Suffolk Jew. So normally what do you do if you have a Suffolk Jew? You convert them, right? Make them a Vaday Jew. Problem is, how do you do Gerus Katan, Giyur on Katan? I remember when I was in yeshiva here in Keren Biavne, we were learning Ksuvas. I remember Shechter came to visit the yeshiva, and he said, what Masechta are you learning? And he said, Ksuvas. And then he said, what daf are you up to? He said, Yiral. He said, okay. And then he got up and he said, Shir for an hour, and Ksuvas daf Yiral on the Ger Katan Sugya. So Rav Shachter does that, Rav Sachs does that also. I said to Rav Sachs, that's like amazing. How do you do that? He goes, They're not learning the most esoteric mesachtas. Okay, fine. So Rav Shach will give a whole share on Ger Katan. So the way Ger Katan works is through Zuchiyah, that he doesn't have das to do anything. So Beis Din is Zach and Lo, we make that decision for him because it's a zechus to be a Jew. But is it a zechus to be a Jew if you can be raised not religious and you're not going to keep Shomer Torah, you're not going to keep Torah mitzvahs? Do you say, it's always better to be a Jew, always better to be a Jew? Or you say, no, it's better to be a non-Jew if you're not going to be observant, right? If you're not going to keep Torah mitzvahs. So Rav Shach thought you can't be Magayer, the kid, because it's not a zechus for him, he's not going to be raised with Torah mitzvahs. So I said to Rav Shach, but wait, isn't it a zechus for him to at least have a vada yichus, to at least know what he is? Meaning there's nothing worse than not being half-half and not knowing where you are. At least a shivcha eniyach, at least a baskar eniyach. You're not able to marry anybody. He's going to be stuck. It's going to be terrible. That's the worst situation. So we don't look at it that way. We can't do a gerus if it's not a zechus for him to be a Jew. So he wouldn't allow the gerus. The grandparents were heartbroken at a grandchild now that may not be a Jew. There are poskim that will say that it's a vaday Jew. Rav Eliashiv held it's a vaday Jew. Rav Eliashiv held it goes by the gestational mother. Rav Eliashiv holds that it's all based on genetics. So and one of the rayas that they bring is that if you were to say it's all the genetic mother, not the gestational. If you say that it's the gestational mother, the woman that carries the pregnancy, so what's going to be when, in very short order, you could raise a baby in a lab, meaning you could use the mother's egg and the father's sperm and have the baby grow in a lab. So who's the mother then? Or Sternbach has such a tshuva in the latest volume of Tshuvas Vanhagos, where he says it was a case where a guy went through a gender change operation, and he had a uterus implanted in him. So a guy became the gestational mother. Right? Geschmack, no? So Sherba said, this guy is the mother. If you hold that the gestational mother is the mother, this child has a male mother. Because you can do all the operations in the world, it's never going to change your gender. That's what we assume in halacha, not like what the Tzitz Eliezer may or may not have said. Right, all the other folks can assume that if you could do all the operations in the world, it's not going to change your gender. So a person can look like a woman, talk like a woman, whatever. Still, if he was born a man, he's a man. So that's what the majority, large majority of folks can hold. But he could be a man, but he's a mother. Wow. When Shmuel's new sefer came out, I thought that was the biggest chiddush in the whole sefer. People were saying all sorts of other things. This kid is that. A man could be a mother. He has a mitzvah to keep an aim on a guy. Wild. These are the things rabbis deal with nowadays, because nowadays it's become very common for people to go through these kinds of things. Geirus, Rabbi Reis was talking about in the Chicago basement, a Geirus candidate that went through a gender change operation. So I would say, no thank you. No, we're not recruiting new Jews. If someone comes and they're very worthy and sincere and that's one thing. We don't need to convert in problems. It's enough that we have to deal with Jews who never have these problems. So we don't want to create that situation. Yeah. Okay, it got really heavy.
Someone who's been in both Torah and Judaism, what do you think the major similarities and differences are in regard to everything? So we moved into
let's talk Lashon Hara for like an hour now. both Lander College and Yeshiva University are outstanding Mekomos HaTorah. Outstanding Mekomos HaTorah, and they're very different from each other in ways that you probably know about. Size is one thing. They're very different from each other in size, and that comes with positives and negatives on both sides. Different types of Torah personalities. You've seen that. You've seen who comes through. For YU and for Lander, both outstanding Torah personalities, but different types and different numbers of Torah personalities. What can I tell you? There are a number of other differences,
How does astrology and the Mazal fit into reasoning? How are you if it's
A mazal Yisrael. We assume that there is mazalos, but not for us. It doesn't mean there is no mazalos for us. It means that we're above the mazalos. We have the right to, the ability to change the mazalos. So we can, we have our bechira chavshus is so powerful that we not only get to choose what to do, we get to choose our destiny. We can actually change our destiny. So we have that kind of power. But yeah, it's clear in Kamus and Chazal that there is such a thing. I would say that if someone comes and claims that they know how to tell by looking at the stars what the future is going to be, that you should check them into an institution, that they're probably not... I was with Rav Asher Weiss a couple of months ago, and a couple of other Rabbanim, and one of the Rabbanim said, do people have Ruach HaKodesh nowadays? Is there such a thing as Ruach HaKodesh nowadays? Rav Asher Weiss said, yes. But if someone comes and tells you that they have Ruach HaKodesh, they probably don't. Meaning, he says, I believe people have Ruach, people have Kedusha, and there is something, that there is a Ruach HaKodesh that's inside of many of us. But if someone claims that they could tell the future because of their Ruach HaKodesh, there was a very celebrated case here in Eretz Yisrael, celebrated not like hoo-hoo, hooray, but like, oy vey, what do we do with this? Where there was a very, very chashva talmid chacham or a shiva, like really knows things really, really well. And he claimed to have Ruach HaKodesh, and he told a woman who came for marriage counseling that that he has Ruach HaKodesh, that her husband is going to die, and she should marry him. And she divorced her husband, that his wife is going to die. This is where his wife is going to die, and that she should divorce her husband and marry him. And she divorced her husband, and then she wasn't even sick, she was fine, so she didn't die. So he's like, sorry, I can't marry you, she's still kicking, you're still around here. Like, what are we gonna do? So she sued him, like it was a whole to-do, and he was a chashava Rosh Yeshiva. So now he promised as part of the settlement in Bezen that he's not going to say that he has Ruach HaKodesh anymore. But, like, what do you do with a person that says that he has Ruach HaKodesh? So, so generally speaking, we assume that if someone's saying that he has Ruach HaKodesh, he probably doesn't. He might be a Meshuggah Ledavar Echad. Doesn't mean everything he did in his life is all possible. It could be that everything he did is really, really good. And yeah, there's Meshuggahs. And we have tshuvas like this. People who, there are famous cases of tshuvas where a husband needed to give his wife a get, but the guy was a Meshuggah Ledavar Echad, that he was totally normal, held a regular job. He just believed that he was Mashiach. So he would run around naked in the streets, and he would, I don't know why he thinks Mashiach did that, but he would grab things from women and climb up the tree and say, I'm not giving it to you until you pronounce me Mashiach. And they'll say, okay, you're Mashiach. And then he'd give them whatever it is that they look for. It's such a concept in Meshuggah Ledavar Echad, whether such a person is considered a shota. If a shota Ledavar Echad is called a shota, there's a lot of tshuvas and poskim about that in you. Right, the Gemara talks about a shota, someone who sleeps in the Beis HaKvaros and who does other things that are destructive or nonsensical. So the question is, does one meshugah, does that necessarily make a person a meshugah? So that's an extreme one. You know, so I would argue that it depends on what the meshugah is, right? Rav Shechter used to always tell us, sometimes like a posek has like one crazy shita. You know, it doesn't make a meshugah just because he has one crazy shita. But the guy who goes around collecting everybody's crazy sheetahs and then makes them all his own, that's Meshuggah. Right? That's how you know, that's Meshuggah.
How does actual halacha interact with Kibud Av Va'Em and what your parents say? That's what, like, Shabbos and other things when you go home and...
So it's Beferes and Shulchan Aruch. There are exceptions to Kibud Av Va'Em. I once gave a shiur on a DRS Shabbaton. The title was Kibud Av Va'Em always applies except exceptions to Kibud Av Va'Em. So one of the exceptions to Kibud Av Va'Em is if your parent tells you to violate Divrei Torah, so you don't listen to them because Kulchem Chayavim B'Kvodi, everyone's Chayav and Kavod HaMakom. Usually that's not exactly what's happening. Usually it's not a parent saying, where's Shatnez? Let me see you put on the Shatnez. They're telling you to do things that you can't think of a mutter way to do, so you have to be creative and figure out a way to, that it might be, figure out what the heter would be. Also, when it comes to Kibud Av Va'Em, it's very important that a person should keep the long view in mind. A lot of times, I would say you should seek Eitza on this, like L'mashal. What's the most famous exception to Kibud Av Va'Em? When don't you have to listen to your parents? What's that? Let's say any halacha, but outside, who to marry, right? Your parent tells you, do not marry that person. You say, but I'm in love with this person, right? So halacha is you're allowed to marry that person. So, but practically, if someone were to come to, I'm a Rebbe, right? So if a Talmud were to come and say, my parents told me not to marry this person, but I love this girl, I want to marry her. If I were to tell the guy, don't worry about it, marry her, so it's a state in Shulchan Aruch. So that would be totally irresponsible. You have to find out. Normally, parents don't hate their children. Normally, parents love their children, and they're concerned for their children. And it could be, it's possible, that with a few more decades of life experience, they're seeing something that you're not seeing. So it's true, push comes to shove, and they're just being insane. Like they say, I always imagined you with a brunette, not with a blonde. You cannot marry her. Okay, so that's crazy. That's insane. You don't have to listen to that. But if they're seeing something, that something's not right, that something that she's too controlling, that she's not firm enough, she's too, but whatever, I don't know, they're seeing something. So it's worthwhile hearing them out and having that conversation and seeing like what, and then talking it through with people that you trust. You know, are these things that can, that will break a marriage? A girl fell in love with a guy, had a situation recently, fell in love with a guy, absolutely wanted to marry him. The guy had a history of, you know, some sort of sexual abuse. You can say, girl, you don't have to listen to your parents. Marry whoever you want. Maybe they're onto something. You know, there might be something there. Maybe not. Maybe he's totally cured. It never really happened. It was all blown out of proportion. It was all okay. But then you need to get the therapist involved, and you want someone to sign on that this person is okay. That this person is. You know, I've had very rarely, I think twice in my years in Rabbanus, where I had to encourage Shidduch to be broken. But it was, they would have told me everything is fine. But I could just, it wasn't, it really wasn't fine. So that's something that, that you know, when it comes to parents asking you to do things, you have to realize your parents can have a relationship with for the rest of your life, hopefully. And they're going to be important to you for the rest of your life. So you try your best to figure out a way that it's not going to destroy the relationship. Now, obviously, they're telling you to be Mechal Shabbos. Not Mechal Shabbos. We had a situation, I was with Rav Shechter once in the OU office on a Friday, and a phone call came in. There was a boy, an NCSY boy, a public school kid, parents not religious, and he's living with his parents. So they don't keep a kosher home. And now he's become religious through NCSY. What's he going to do, move out? He's a ninth grader. Where's he going to go? There's nowhere to go. So he's got to eat what they feed him. So his shaila was, should I wash at every meal? So that way, I'll say a bracha on the bread. The bread is kosher. And then I don't have to worry about saying bracha on non-kosher food. And he's in Mavaris over the night. So Shachar just cried for like 10 minutes straight. Said, yeah, it's a good cheshbon. But you're going to tell him to move out. You have to realize he needs to be a healthy person first. And then eventually, obviously that's an extreme circumstance. But we had a case, my old chavrusa from Karen Biavna, Jonah Lerner, is a he runs NCSY of the something. He lives in Baltimore, so whatever region that is. So Northeast, something? Anyone know Jonah Lerner?
Atlantic Seaboard.
Atlantic Seaboard, maybe. So he's, so I just saw him this week. But I remember years ago when we were in a Shachar Shir together, he had a shaila with an NCSYer who the father was from. No, the father was not from. The mother was from. The parents were divorced. The mother was from, but she was an absolute meshugah. She made him crazy. So they asked who the kid should live with. So Shachar Paskin, the father. He's got to be normal first. And after he's normal, then he could be from. You got to be because the frum kite's not going to last if the person's not a stable person, if you're not a stable human being. That has to come first. So there are a lot of cheshbonos that have to be taken into account. It's not something that you could just give like a one-off answer on. It's something. This is why in life you need a rebbe, and you need to find the right rebbe. You need someone who you can trust, who's totally unbiased, right, and who will and is a pikeach. You know, is wise, knows how to think about this. I'm very fortunate in my life, in most of my major life decisions, my 10th grade Rebbe has guided me in most of my major life decisions. Adayo. Because he's someone who just wanted to give his whole life to his talmidim, and he does, ad hayom. And he's a tremendous pikeach. And so, yeah, I had a lot of other great rebbeim I also go to. I had Rav Silver and Karim Yavne and Rav Shachta, obviously. I also go to Freitz all the time. But it's important to have someone who can guide you.
What degree is a conformity a Torah value, and why do you think that manifests differently in different...
So what degree is what a Torah?
Conformity.
Conformity, a Torah value. So I would say like this. Torah values are things that the Torah talks about. Anything outside of what the Torah talks about is not a Torah value. It's a value that sometimes fits with the Torah and sometimes doesn't. To what degree is, this is the way the question is normally asked, but I'm going to say it as the same question. To what degree is feminism a Torah value? Well, it depends. If your feminism means that women have to observe mitzvahs too, they also need to eat a kazayis matzah. Very much a Torah value. Women are chayiv in kazayis matzah. Kol sheyeshem bal tochel chametz yeshem b'kom echol matzah. Absolutely. Chiv daraisa to eat matzah even though it's mitzvah shazman grama. If feminism means that whatever a man can do, we can do better, and therefore, you know, we should learn from the Torah and whatever, and, you know, and count toward a minion. Well, that's not a Torah value. That's against the Torah. And the Eidah has to be dafka made up of men. Women don't count. So is feminism anti-Torah? Is feminism like the Torah? No, it's just not a... The Torah doesn't talk about it because it's not something the Torah is goris. Any particular application of it has to be put through the measure of what the Torah has to say about it. That's in general, I don't like to talk about, you know, values that aren't really, they're not Torah values. They're not anti-Torah values. So conformity, sometimes the Torah thinks, it's a very good idea to conform. If everyone around you is wearing tzitzit and yarmulke, you too should wear tzitzit and yarmulke. If everyone else is learning Torah, you too should learn Torah. If everyone around you is speaking Lashon Hara and, I don't know, what else do people commonly violate? I don't know. Jeweling? I don't know, whatever. So you should not. You should not conform to something like that. You conform to that which is... Now, if you find that the whole world is doing one way and you're doing another way and you're convinced that it's right, so it could be that it's worthwhile rethinking, you know, whether you're right or not. My mother-in-law has a friend who is a little bit of an absent-minded person, very, very absent-minded person. And she was on the highway once driving on, let's say, Route 80, just pick a highway, and she turned on the radio and she heard that there's one crazy person driving the wrong way on Route 80. Watch out, there's someone going in the wrong direction. And this woman's driving thinking, everybody's going in the wrong direction on Route 80. She's driving down seeing everybody going in the other. So, LMI. Everyone was not going in the wrong direction. The one crazy person was going in the wrong direction. But a person in their own mind, they think that they're doing right. So sometimes you have to look around and say, well, if everyone else thinks that I'm a meshugana, and that everything else is, so maybe I need to reassess. But I don't know if there's such a Torah value. That's the whole basis of El Sefer Orchos Hadikim, my favorite Moshe Sefer. What does Orchos Hadikim do? It takes each midah, and it shows you how that midah is good and bad. What do you mean, good and bad? How could Gaiva is like, you would think, the absolute worst mitzvah in the whole world. How could it be good? Sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's important to have a little bit of shtalt, a little bit of pride, a little bit of not to be a shmata, not to be, sometimes, very, 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 very rarely, but sometimes. So every mitzvah is like that. So I think conformity is the same. Yeah? First of all, if a person knows that they're unable to have, this is a question in Minchas Chinuch in Mitzvah Aleph, whether a mamzer is chayiv in Peruvu, right? Because on the one hand, why not? He's chayiv in mitzvahs. This is not exactly the same question. We'll explain why in a second. On the other hand, you can't be marv mamzer in Yisrael. Right, so maybe better for him not to be married. Over here, you talk about a person who's physically unable to have children, so he's never going to be, he's chayiv in Peruvu, he's the anusrach manapatre, he can't do the mitzvah of Peruvu. So that's the question of whether getting married is an independent mitzvah or not. When you get married, there is great value in being married, that's for sure. There's great value in being married to find someone that you can share your life with, find someone who understands you better than you understand yourself, find someone who will be able to tell you when you're You know, when everyone else is standing up when you walk in the room and calling you rabbi, and this woman will say to you, you're an idiot. Don't you dare do that, right? You need someone like that in your life. It's important. Shai Shachter once told me that. He said, you ever hear the way my mother talks to my father? That's by design. He insists on that. He needs someone to talk to him like that, you know? It's, so there's great value. Is it a chiyuv? Chayev Adam Isha, I don't know. I think the Lashon of Shulchan Aruch is that Chayev Adam Isha Kidei, in order that, the first Lirbos, in order that they should have children. So maybe it wouldn't be a Chayev. It wouldn't be a Chayev. Right? What was that? Like someone who's Nafshu Chashka B'Torah. Right? The Gemara says. What was it? In Zoma? What was it? Can you remember? Nafshu. What? Benazai, right? Nashla Hashka Torah, therefore he didn't get married. Okay, you could have such a person.
And is that first, like, the person who marries him able to marry?
Yes, so a woman has no mitzvah of peruvu. A woman, in all likelihood, will very much want to have children. Meshchachma discusses why it is famous Meshchachma, why it is that women are not mitzvah of peruvu. And he says that it's a very painful thing for women to go through. The Torah is not, he's not going to give her a mitzvah. That's such a painful thing. But in order to sort of counter that, of course, Baruch Hu built in the teva of an isha that she's always going to want to have children. So very often, not very often, every once in a while you have a case where a guy and a girl are going to get married, and the girl is going to say, I know that he's never going to be able to have children, but I don't care. I love him anyway. And hopefully a wise parent or mentor will grab the girl, shake her a little bit, and say, that's what you think now when you're 19. When you're 29, you're going to think differently. Because she's allowed to, but it's unlikely that she'll be happy with that. Now, I would say this. A lot of times, people who 20 years ago, 30 years ago, would have been told, you're never, ever going to have children, it is no longer true. What fertility medicine is able to do nowadays is unbelievable. Unbelievable. People who are guaranteed that they're never going to have children are having, in Shari Tzedek now, it was in the fertility lab there with Rav Asher Weiss last year. He took a tour of Rabbanim. It was unbelievable. They told us that they have people who were told they're never going to have children that are having their eighth and ninth children. And they're making them there in the lab. It's unbelievable. It's crazy. Mamish, like you see, like, Klal Yisrael growing in Shari Tzedek. It's unbelievable. So a lot of times they can't have children. Rashlomo Kluger points out on the first page in Ebenezer that if a couple is unable to have children, if a man is unable to have children, there's a partial key mitzvah for Ruvu to adopt. Because the Gemara says that kol megadol yasam b'toch beiso is ki ilu yiladam. So when you raise a yasam in your house, it's as if yiladam. So Rashlomo Kluger understands that as a halachic statement, that it's certainly a hashkafic statement, that it's really a nice thing to do to be megadol yasam. It's certainly a nice thing to do to be Megadol Yasam B'Soch Beis. So this is Maral and Chumash. Maral says that when the astrologers, coming back to the other question, when the astrologers saw that Paro, that there's going to be a Ben that's born, but we can't tell if he's a Mitzri or if he's a Jew, so Paro goes there. Even the Mitzri boys have to be thrown into the river. So Maral says, why couldn't they tell through the stars if it was going to be a Mitzri or a Jew? Why weren't the stars clear? So Maral says, they were clear. He was the son of a Jewish woman and the son of a Mitzri woman. How is Moshe Rabbeinu the son of a Mitzri woman? That's a reality. That's to be taken literally. So there's a partial key of mitzvah approval to raise a child, which also tells you, Rashad points out, that the mitzvah approval is not fulfilled when you biologically have the children. You then also have to raise them, because that's also part of it, meaning it works both ways. That's also part of the mitzvah. Once you biologically have the children, you're not done yet. You then have to raise the children. So raising children is a key mitzvah peruvu. It used to be that when people would adopt, they would tell them to adopt goyim, because then you could do a giur on the child and ger katan at the age of 13. They'll give him the option. No. You know, if he wants to stay a Jew, and usually a 13-year-old wants to stay in his parents' house and with the way he was raised. Later he might change his mind, but that's too late already. Then he's a Jew. Right, so usually a 13-year-old is in. So they used to tell them, why would they tell them not to adopt Jewish babies? Because you don't know the yichus. It could be that they're mamzerim. So like organizations like Ohel are very, very helpful. Because they know, they find these babies that need homes. And they find them Jewish babies, and they find them Jewish homes, and they're able to tell you that the baby's not a mamzer. It's not just going through the services that the government has. You're going through Jewish people who understand. So it's a great, great tikkun. That's a great kiyum mitzvah then, for someone to adopt such a child. Because then they're being, it's kiyum yiladim, it's kiyum mitzvah for everyone. Save, and being matzil nefesh achas mi Yisrael, because who knows where the kid would end up if he doesn't end up in the Jewish home. So it's special, tzaddikim and tzidkanyas. They say the Lubavitcher Rebbe used to be very against adoption. He used to advise everyone not to adopt. Anyone Lubavitcher here? Anyone have a Lubavitcher connection? I don't know why that is, why he was against it. I'm assuming it related to something about the giur and whatever, but I'm not sure. He always told people not to adopt. There's one exception that I know of. This is just like a crazy cool story, so I'm going to tell it to you. There's a guy, a Talmud of mine, who just got married, actually. He and his brother were both Talmidim, and he has a third brother. His oldest brother was adopted. And his parents are extremely wealthy. Very, very, very big Balei Tzedakah. And he's just extremely wealthy. His father is like one of the top guys in the highest, the best performing fund on Wall Street for the last 30 years running. Like, very, very wealthy family. So this guy told me that the father, this kid's father, is my father's age. They're friends from like Brooklyn. Now, I'm way older than this kid. I was his Rebbe. So his parents didn't have children for a long, long time. And he was in a job on Wall Street, wasn't going so well. And they went to Lubavitcher Rebbe for a bracha. And the Rebbe said to the wife, to this kid's mother, the Rebbe said, give it to me. Tell me everything you're feeling. Share all your pain. Don't hold back just because I'm a Rebbe. And she's quite a personality. And she let it out. Let out all of her pain and all of her, it's terrible. And in Cain, Lamaze, Anochi, and the Rebbe gave her $2. I'm not a Chabad Chassid. I don't know what to make of the story. I have no idea what to do with this. The Rebbe gave her $2. And said, you should adopt a child, and then you'll have two sons. The Rebbe never ever told anybody to adopt. Said, you should adopt a child, then you'll have two sons. Doctors told her she's not going to have children. Everyone told her she's not going to have children. And then he gave the father $6, which is an unusual number, and he said, you're going to have abundant hatzlacha. That's when he figured out the equation that made his fund the highest performing. And like since then, he's been like, he's a billionaire. I don't know how much money he has. I guess we can count other people's money. He's got a lot. And they adopted a child. They had one son after they adopted a child. The doctor said, you're crazy if you try again. Don't try again. So they didn't. A messenger came from the Rebbe. I said, two sons. And the second one just got married this week. What do you do with that? The Nachabal Chassid. They don't act like Chassid. They're not Chabad Chassid. This is the mice that they told me. I don't know what to do with it if anyone knows. Yeah. Okay. The Gemara says in Maseches Brachos and Dafei that in Chavash Matir Atzim in Beis Asuri, that someone doesn't have the capacity to get themselves out of jail. The Rebbe gave brachas to all these people that seemingly were Makliyim. He himself, he couldn't pay the Chavish Matzah, so he didn't have any children.
Why is it easy in some of like a sports game or some other books you read, do you remember your learning even yesterday?
So, very good. Excellent question. Right? Why is it so much easier? Why do I still remember how many doubles Don Mattingly hit in 1986? But I can't tell you whatever, the Gemara and brachas and Right? It's a very good question. So I remember once there was a Sichas Musar in the Beis Medrash in YU when I was a Talmud there. My Chavrusa was Dovi Bilit, Rabbi Bilit's oldest son. He has older daughters, but this is Rabbi Bilit's oldest son. So I was talking to Dovi, and the Sichas Musar, whoever gave it, was hysterical. They said the funniest things. So I was causing off all the jokes like 2 weeks later. And then after a short while later, I was talking to him about like Rav Shechter. How does Rav Shechter remember everything? He's like, how do you remember those jokes from 2 weeks ago? Because you enjoyed them. They were like what you wanted. And when you enjoy something and you love it, So you'll be chasering it over in your mind all the time. It'll be, it'll be something that you're constantly thinking about. And when you think about something, you remember it. That's all it is. So Rabbi Shai Shaster likes to go around saying, my father is not a genius. That is a lie. Okay? I told him that to his face. It was a bald-faced lie. His father is a genius. There's no doubt. Because what makes a genius? When someone, I don't think he's intending to lie. I think he means something else. But I'm not picking a fight with he's one of my closest friends. So what does it mean? He means something else by that. What he's trying to say is that he wouldn't be a Talmud Chacham if he didn't love learning and if he wasn't such a huge masmid. And that's true. That's true. That's 100% true. He just loves learning. All he wants to do is learn. And all he's thinking about all day is learning. You know, I mentioned before when I said that I had a Talmud that wanted to get married on Hanukkah, so Shaftah said, tell them to get married before Hanukkah. Right? Did I say that line before? Yeah. So where does that come from? Why does he say that? Because that's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says, don't marry a woman, b'moed, because v'ein marvin simcha v'simcha, v'sach smayt katan. Rather, you should get married before moed, so it wouldn't be bittul piri of rivia. Right? Because to wait till Moed is one of the reasons, I was just confused. There are a few reasons not to get married on Moed. One of them is simple. The other one is Bizzal Birvirvia to wait till Moed. So get married earlier. His Sichas Chulin is learning. Everything he says, it's a Gemara. Once I had a situation where a woman called up, I was in the OU office, a woman called up, I'm stuck in Iowa. And I don't have, remember this? We discussed this, child, and I don't have any wine. How should I say Kiddush? I'm stuck for Shabbos. I found some challah rolls. What should I do for Kiddush? So Shat said, buy some grapes and crush the grapes before Shabbos. What kind of ridiculous thing? You know how many grapes you have? She's like, should I put them in the bathtub and step on them? what are you talking about? But it's a Gemara, the Gemara in Bava Basra. What is it, like Tzadi Dalet or something? The Gemara in Bava Basra says that's what you do. You sochet enough because Gemara talks about being sochet enough that doesn't need to have alcohol. Can you be sochet enough and kaddish lev kiddush hayom? So yeah, everything you see, even the sichas chulin. So what you find is that when you're thinking, when your mom is thinking about something all the time, you remember it. So the question is, how do you get to that point, right? So Chazal give us a few memory aids. Chazal tell us, you should make simanim l'Torah. Anyone here familiar with this new program called Zichru? Seen it? It works. It's mamish amazing. My son is in ninth. Zichru is this program. A couple of guys from Passaic, Rabbi Goldhar and Barry Leibovitz, no relation. Two guys from Passaic. They got together and they came up with this program. Rabbi Goldhar, I think, is a memory expert, and Barry Leibovitz, Daf Yomi Magachir, and he's a lawyer. He's also a brilliant guy. And they came up using memory devices to remember Daf Yomi. Because the big complaint against Daf Yomi is I'm not going to remember anything. So what they did is they picked three main points on each daf to remember, and they came up with something ridiculous, like a ridiculous picture to picture in your mind that encapsulates all three points. The more absurd the picture is, the better it is. And they have like a simon for each daf. Like, I don't know, what are we up to Daf Yomi now? We're up to Daf Kovzai. So ask me anything from base to Kovzai. Give me Daf Yotes. So Daf Yotes is a yacht. Yotes, yacht. So the three sugyas to remember is just picture the guy on the yacht, this mean guy on a yacht that's cursing Talmidei Chachamim, that's telling Lashon Hara about Talmidei Chachamim, and then he falls overboard into an open mouth of a whale, and then the captain of the ship rips off his shatnez costume to jump in. So what does that picture tell you? That's one. Al tiftach pel the satan. That's two. The open mouth of the whale. Kavod Rabriels dochlo seishabatori wearing shatnez post shafilu b'shuk. So that's your test. Like that, right? And I never remembered anything. I have like the worst memory. But like you picture such a crazy picture, and then when you're driving from Reish Yerushalayim to Keren B'Yavneh, and you can't get your Wayu Torah app to work, you can chaz over the first 26 blot of the second brachos twice, three times. Right? Twice until your daughter calls from New York and says good morning. Then, okay, But you could, and you're constantly chazering. You're constantly thinking of these things. So you make simanim, and you constantly chazer in your mind, and it could work. Now to remember details, that's where a shachter comes in. That's the reason of shachter in normal people. Like there's a level of memory for details is insane. Rav Silver told us when we came to Yavne. Rav Silver told us that he said, you know, people should learn like they study secular subjects. We'd be better off. So that's an intriguing thing to say. What do you mean, Rebbe? So when you study bio, you prepare for the test at the end. Right? You study it to know it. When people learn, they think it's like, oh, it's good enough that I'm learning. I'm doing mitzvahs. Prepare it to know it. Go in it to know it. Right? When your brother finishes shas at his chasana, right? He didn't just learn shas. Knows it. As Rav Chaim Kanievsky, right? Chaim Kanievsky said at the Seema Shas, you see the video? They thought that he'd be so impressed that there are like 100,000 people finishing Shas. They're like, all of these Jews are finishing Shas. He's like, yeah, come back to me when they know it. You know, like he was totally unimpressed. And they showed that as a video. It was a little absurd. So you got it, but it's kedai to come up with something. I always had one mahalich my whole life, and I think the Zichron mahalich is much better than my mahalich. My mahalik didn't work. my ninth grader started. I have a ninth grader started ninth grade in DRS. Ninth grade. So he's learning brachos from Rabbi Kamenetsky Shir. And so I said, brachos, you got to. It's Dav Yomi. For 2 months at least, you'll finish the Masechta. He and his friends were sitting around on Shabbos one day after davening before lunch. And I told him and his friends, I was really mostly joking with his friends, were serious about him. And they all did it. They all started doing it. Okay, 2 out of 4 dropped out already, but still, they did it. So my son is doing zichrus. Rabbi Storch, every time he sees him in the hallway in the DRS, he goes, Tata Zayin, what are you? You know, and he could do it. He's a ninth grader. He's not smarter than anyone here. Right? You could do it.
With the whole thing about like women wearing men clothing, men wearing women clothing, what's Israeli hold about women wearing pants or let's say just to go to sleep, even like something more comfortable, would that be different?
So there are two things. There's a tzmius issue and then there's a begadish issue. Begadish squared. Ooh. So there's as far as the tznius issue is concerned, so that's a legitimate concern. Meaning a woman will say, well, it's loose pants, it's not form-fitting, and the skirts sometimes are so tight that they're not snoring. That's all true. But the gadol, typically if a woman's wearing pants, she's going to end up wearing, usually it's not the most tznius situation. So that's for outside. For inside the house, is it really begadish if it's pants that are made for a woman? And if a man tried on, he'd be in pain, right? That is a dafka made for a woman. So you can't say that that's begadish. It's obviously made for a woman. So she can go to sleep in such a thing. I don't see a problem with that. When a woman is in need, there's a shayla how she should dress, around her husband, because the husband's not allowed to be mistakel and become a mechusim shabbat. But even then, to wear pants, it's covering her whole body. Well, I don't think that that's a problem.
In regards to getting gifts, like you have money for Hanukkah or birthday or whatever, do you have to give Maaser?
Yeah, so Pashtus, whatever you need to support yourself, basic support for yourself, if you can't afford to support yourself, Maaser is Machlokas Sri Machlokas Rishonim was Baraisa Draban Raminog. We pass the Maaser Ksafim as a Minog. So it's a very good Minog, a very strong Minog, a very important Minog. But Pashtus is that you should give on gifts, on monetary gifts. I don't think you have to give on gifts I don't think you have to get an assessor to come down to evaluate, your iPod or there's no such thing, your iPhone or whatever, to see, say you can give 10% of that. I think monetary gifts, money made, I think that is included in the minhag. I don't think things are included in the minhag. Couples get married, they always ask this question. A couple gets married and they have wedding gifts. So they have to give Maaser for wedding gifts. So if they're really counting on that to live, because they don't have any money, which, it's your responsibility, we're all young men in this room, you can get married one day, and when you make that Kabbalah's Kinyan on the Ksuba, you're accepting upon yourself. Right? You're going to support. So you may get lucky, and you may have a parent or an in-law that says, nah, learn, it's okay. But you certainly have no right to tell them that they have to support you while you want to learn. And it's your responsibility, right? So it could be that just to get by while you're trying to finish school or while you're trying to find a job, that you're going to need that money. So then I think the Chiyah Gavna, lo nahagu, the minhag doesn't apply. I would still say, I always tell guys that sometimes you're not that far away from this. I know it seems far away. You're like just a couple of years away from this. But guys will say, we got married. Our parents are supporting us by giving us X amount of money. They budgeted it us. They're giving us X till I finish dental school and my wife finishes occupational therapy school or whatever, right? So this is how much they budgeted for us, right? So they want to know they have to give Meiser on the money that their parents are giving them, meaning they are their parents' Meiser, right? They're tzedakah because they're poor. They don't have any money. So I always tell them, you're not chayv Meiser. But it's a good idea to remain in the habit of giving. And this is a yisod gadol. If a person gets in the habit of just hoarding everything for himself, it's going to be very hard to become a giver later in life. I mean, fundamentally, you want to be a giving person. You want to be someone who gives. So you want to exercise that muscle a little bit, that giving muscle a little bit. Because God willing, one day, some of you, maybe all of you, will be gvirim and ashirim and whatever, and you'll be in a position where you can help others. So you want to do it bahafrazi. You want to do it with Rav Shechter told us that when he was younger, he said he couldn't afford to pay tuition for all of his kids. He has 9 kids, Kanaidahara, and he said, I took tuition assistance because I needed it. He said, now I'm an usher muflag. So I give 50% of my money to tzedakah. It's funny that he calls himself an usher muflag. When I used to repeat that over, I would say, I don't know why you pay, but now I know. So I don't think he owns an automobile, you know? He doesn't own a car. But he's an usher muflag. He's got a big apartment in Washington. So he gives 50% of his money to tzedakah. So, but that's because he said that all those years, my wife would volunteer all of her extra time in the yeshiva to work for these because we were taking tuition assistance. How could we not? We had to give. So as you give and give and give, eventually you'll be able to... And that's what Shemesh Kapra writes in the instructions, Shari Yosha. It's like, Kodesh Baruch, that's why all those Maimari Chazal, Melech Mamun Chaser, Aser Taser, Aser Bishvil Shet Tashar, that the more you give, it's like Kodesh Baruch is making an investment with you. You give something to someone to invest money, you give someone money to invest for you, so when they invest the money and it does really, really well, what do? You give them more. So Kodesh Baruch gives you money and he sees that you're doing well with it, you're giving tzedakah, he'll give you more. He'll know that you're a worthy gabbai tzedakah. So he'll give you more money to distribute. That's the way the Ribbono Shel Olam works.
Just as a continuation of that, also sometimes when you're in Yerushalayim, you'll see someone who, you know, you came to Israel in 9th grade, they were in the same spot, so I think that's a view of, I mean, I know you don't necessarily have a chiyuv unless they're...
By the Kotel or whatever.
So
the Gemara in Babasra, you learn tzedakah for gifts. Yeah? So the Gemara in Babasra says that someone is not Zocha, so he's going to be nichshol by giving to people who don't really need, charlatans, right? And if someone is Zocha, all the Kodesh Baruch Hu will see to it that all the money that he gives goes to the right places. But it's mavur from there that if a Kodesh Baruch Hu trusts you with money, you're supposed to be chashbin about it. Sometimes people think, if I have money, I'll just give to everybody. Maybe that's not why Hashem gave you money. Maybe Hashem gave you money so that you could think about what the right thing to do with that money is, the right place to give it. So I would, to give a dollar is one thing, but to be giving large amounts of money to people that you don't know need it, you're much better off giving in places where you know that there's a need and you know that the money is going to be used properly. You know, that I was one of my talmidim in YU Smicha now is a little bit of a. He's a genius. He actually is a Keren Biavna alumnus. He's an absolute genius. And he's a little bit out there in terms of the way he thinks about things and does things. So he said, I was walking in Central Park at 3 a.m. last night. Like, that's how the conversations often start with him. He says, and a man came over to me and asked me for $10 for cocaine. He said, I was impressed with his honesty. So I asked him, where can you get cocaine for $10? So he was like, is there a mitzvah for me to give him Darkei Shalom? No, we're trying to say Aniyah Yaakov and Aniyah Yisrael and Mishim Darkei Shalom. Probably not. He's going to be using it as cocaine. Probably not. Probably not. You got to know what time you guys... we're done? Yeah, one more? So whenever they want to finish, they would say, one more, right? Okay. So one more question? Make sense? Yeah? I don't want to take up your whole afternoon, I feel like. I'm enjoying myself, but you know, some guys say, this is KBY. You guys would be like, this guy's killing our whole Seder. Two more. Yeah. Yes, but it's unclear why. It's my name. Meaning, now that we use them as pets, it's not abundantly clear why they should still be Muslim, but all the posts, for some reason, still say that they're Muslim. I don't know, above my pay grade. I don't know why. But they are, apparently. Yeah.
What role can a Jew have in public causes which are completely halakhically mutter?
In what?
Public causes.
Public causes that are totally halakhically mutter, such as?
Yeah, like, you know, jobs that you're going to be, like, top-notch, or, like, you know, politician, or different things like that.
Why not? I mean, it's important that we have Jews that are involved in, it's important that we have firm Jews that are involved in things that impact the larger community. You know, if a Jew is running the American Cancer Society or something like that, that's great. I mean, we're affected by that. We're part of a unique clan called the Jewish people, but we're also part of humanity. And things that affect all of humanity should be our concern as well. And certainly if you're living in a country where there are hundreds of millions of people, and Jews are many of them, we're part of that, so it's in our best interest that the country runs well. There's a guy in my shul who was just promoted to captain, the rank of captain in the New York Police Department, New York City Police Department. So now he had all sorts of shilas. Should he, like, because if something goes down on Shabbos, he's off on Shabbos. But if something happens, they need to do a drug raid. They need, there's some sort of public safety issue. Nothing happens without him, right? If a cop gets shot, they need to call him. So he had all these shilas about Shabbos and whatever. So the question is, should a Jew be a captain in the police department to begin with? So I think there's a good argument to be made that it's kedai that we have some people in that in those kinds of positions. I don't think everyone has a cleave to go into those kinds of positions, but it's not a bad idea that the Jewish people, that the specifically religious Jews, are represented. And I think that the police department is more capable of protecting us when they have us among them. I mean, that's what they say about security guards at shuls. That one of the problems with hiring outside security is, you know, if the guy from the movie that's playing the chassid in the movie, right? You ever seen a chassid in the movie? He's got long flowing hair and just like, you know, fake pay is sticking out of him. Like, that's not what a chassid looks like. But to a guy, that looks just like a chassid, right? So if that's the guy standing security, he's just some guy with like long flowing hair and like pay comes in, he'll be like, oh, it looks like an Orthodox Jew, and he'll let him right through. But we would know to stop them. Meaning like little bits of yediyah that you would only know from the inside is valuable for us to have. So I think in public causes to represent us, I think it's very important that we have people. Again, you don't have the chiyuv to be those people, but I think it's important that we have people in those positions. You guys should have continued hatzlacha, abundant hatzlacha in your learning. Thank you so much for this conversation. I enjoyed talking to you guys. If anyone has questions about YU or comparing YU and Lennon, I'm happy to share with you.